psychological force producing an unbridled sexual desire, a longing for a person, circumstance, or fulfilling of the emotion. Defined as immoral, as the desire for the object or action is governing the person's intellect, rather than the intellect and will governing the appetite for that object. This imbalance can transform one into a slave of the devil. The feeling fades.
They sat across from me, or looking to the ground, embarrassed him more so. He cheated. Where did it start? The secret sin of lust. It started small, and then it grew and grew and grew and became real, and he couldn't stop. The fantasy became reality. In our fantasy life, sexually toward others is called lust. And it's one of the seven deadly sins. One of the things that throughout church history, the church has said, this thing could ruin your life, but there's a virtue that can make you flourish, which we're going to talk about, but this sin could destroy you. The sin of lust, the sexual sin, defines our lives, defines our culture. And if you're saying you're someone that it doesn't affect or you don't struggle with, you're either dead or you're lying. Here's the definition of lust. Lust is a strong passion of longing, especially for sexual desire. When we objectify another person for our own personal pleasure, that's lust. And it was in the garden. Adam and Eve, they looked at the tree that they weren't supposed to touch, and the text says it was pleasing to the eye. That's the thing. It had this aesthetical power over them, over Eve. And then she says, hey, Adam partake. And then, of course, people go, see, look, you know, she was weak and she fell asleep. The text actually says, and she gave the fruit to her husband who was there with her. They were there together, deranged in their minds, not doing what God had set out. He had said, I want you to flourish. I want you to have pleasure. And they did the one thing he said not to do. This is what we do with lust. Adam and Eve weren't thinking straight. We don't think straight. That's lust. It can derail us. It can derail our marriage. It can derail our friendships. It can derail our private spiritual life between God and us and people. That's what lust does, because it takes a power over your feeling, which, you know, when I do weddings, I love to get up and do these vows in front of the couples, and they are looking at each other with such love and affection toward one another. And I always want to kind of fast forward 15 years when, you know, they've got a couple kids and, you know, they're not all dressed up nice like on this particular day, and they're not feeling that for each other. And maybe they haven't had sex for a month, and he goes to the grocery store and there's a lady on aisle four, and she's kind of batting her, you know, beautiful eyes to him, and he starts to feel the butterflies in his stomach. And I always, you know, like to look at people and say, be careful how you feel. It can destroy your life. It can derail you. It can mess us up. And that's what lust is. Now, it can mess us up in big ways. Pornography, promiscuity. These are huge ways. The two most vicious, in many ways, attacks on God's ordained way of sexuality in our lives. To have lives driven by lust so much that people literally become enslaved to it. Soren Kierkegaard, who was this philosopher, he said, there's a lot of people who view freedom wrong. Our culture, we think freedom means doing whatever you want sexually, right? That's what the 60s were all about. Let's free everybody up to do that. We define that as freedom. But Kierkegaard said, you know, when you define your life by how you feel in every moment, that's the ultimate slavery. That you just do whatever feels good. But the problem is sometimes, like marriage, you actually have to covenant yourself to something. Or like a relationship with God, where you're gonna actually be obedient even in the midst of a thing that might not feel good in this moment, because you have a much bigger eternal perspective than what's the flashy sparkle thing that feels good in the next 4 minutes. And Kierkegaard said, see, the irony is that's the ultimate slavery. So what do? We follow after this never-ending appetite called lust. Because there's always someone hotter. There's always someone sexier. There's always someone who can make you feel this way or that way. It's never ending. And we follow that instinct, we die. So what's the way out of it? We got to talk about that. Because here's one of the passages that we want to have very center in our hearts and minds throughout this series. Romans 8:13 is one of those passages that actually tells us how to be free. It goes, if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. That's what we got to talk about. We got to explore both sides of those things. Life according to the sin and the death it brings and the life when we kill this sin. John Owen, way back in the day, wrote a book called The Mortification of Sin. He said, you better be killing sin or it will be killing you. And this sin can derail your life. Practically, it's going to come between you and God. It's going to come between you and people. So what does God say to do? There's a bunch of passages in the Bible. Let me hit you with a few of them. 2 Timothy chapter 2 says, flee also youthful lusts, pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So flee that and then pursue these things. 1 Peter chapter 2 verse 11 goes, I urge you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 says this, shun fornication. Every sin that a person commits is outside the body, but fornication is a sin against the body itself. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 says this, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that each one of you know how to control your own body in holiness and honor, not with lustful passion like those who do not know God. See, this is one of the biggest, most convicting sins because God knows that things are going to derail in our life. And this is why Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, says this, I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. See, he goes, this is a heart issue. So why do we struggle with this sin so much? I think there's two big reasons why we struggle with lust so much. The first is because of us. Okay, we're sinful, right? We're in our nature, in our genes, we are fallen. We have proclivities towards sin and pleasure and stuff that is short-term gains and wins, even to stuff that God goes, you got to run from this. It's like we need to figure it out ourselves. It's like we need to fall on our face ourselves, even though God goes, warning, 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 don't go down this road. And we go, well, why doesn't he want us to? I don't understand. It's like my kids. I'm like, guys, I bought them all skateboards for Christmas. Don't go outside without your helmet. All right, without your like elbow pads or else you're gonna get hurt. And they're all like, what are you talking about? And they go, boom. Yeah, daddy, I don't know why. I'm like, what are you, dumb? Right, so here's God going, guys, this thing is gonna destroy you. It's personal, it's individual, and that's the problem. We feed it and we feed it and we feed it because we look at porn or we look at this naked person in a billboard or we open a magazine and we see all these things. And instead of turning away from those moments, we feed it. And then it starts small and it grows and it grows and it grows. And every time we feed it, it grows. And so we watch that thing or we give a little bit there. And we even know this scientifically. Here's what happens. Scientists have started to explore our brains. And they're finding that our brains literally rewire when we look at things enough and we feed them certain information. It's called neuroplasticity. And it's literally that you start to look at something and the brain wiring starts to change, like your brain is malleable. It's like plastic. And so one scientist says this, just as plastic is changeable, we can change the shape of the brain. See, your brain is constantly changing and molding itself. Everything you do makes certain neural pathways and connections so it can do it faster the next time. So when you listen to music, when you watch sports and it starts to train itself, your brain can literally change itself and it could be a different brain today than it was yesterday. So one scholar says this, we can train our brain in something and then grow that area. Now listen to this, this is fascinating, which means we have more capacity in that area to process incoming stimuli. So if you train a lot in math, your brain area that focuses on that responds to math calculations. It's going to grow and get better and better each time. Everything that we do each and every day shapes our brain to do what it is. If one watches porn or lustful images, they train their brain and there's a response that happens in our brains that it actually starts to enlarge in that area. Now, Here's what we have to actually understand. When that starts to happen, then we need more stimuli in order to feed that area of our brain. So it starts to move quicker in that area, it enlarges, and now we need more stimuli to actually feed it. So there's a piece of it that we struggle with this because we're sinful. And we're depraved as human beings. And when Christians talk about total depravity, they don't mean that we're utterly depraved, like we have nothing good about us. They mean that we're sin actually affects every part of our being, including our sexuality, right down to the level of our brain. In that sense, Augustine was a little bit wrong. We're not just what we love, we are what we think about. We're not just about our hearts, we're about our brains. Now, here's the second reason I think we struggle with this sin so much. First reason's because of us. Second reason is because of them. And here's what I mean. This isn't just a personal, individual challenge. This is a social one. Guys, we live in Babylon, all right? We don't live in heaven. We live in a culture defined by lust. Everywhere you go, every commercial, every advertisement, you can be scrolling on your feed, it's bodies, it's sexuality. You could go on news websites, go on CNN, go on Fox News, wherever you're on, it's half-naked girls. Why? Because sex sells. It's money, it's attention. And people who struggle with this sin are constantly fighting it. We have to recognize that. We realize that that's a thing. So don't be naive about it. I remember years ago, I was in this this men's group and a bunch of the guys were kind of struggling with, oh, I don't want to look at this and I don't want to do that. And so one of the guys brought this book and it was called Every Man's Battle. And it's all about the battle and struggling with lust and sexuality and whatever. And the opening story is about this guy who bought a Mercedes. He'd saved up a bunch of money and he's driving his Mercedes one day and he sees this girl and she's jogging down the street and she's, you know, she's all, he describes it, you know, and she's all sweaty and kind of doing her jogging thing. And he's like looking at her and he cranes his neck. Not that any of you have done this before. And he watching her and watching her and watching her. And then all of a sudden he crashes his Mercedes into a post and he's got to go and explain to his wife what was going on. He said, from that moment on, I realized I had a problem. Well, remember, one of the guys took this book home and he put it on his nightside table and he was kind of reading it like, man, this is a struggle in my life. I got to look at this thing. And he was out at work one day and his wife picked it up and she read it, the whole book. And he comes home from work and she's standing there as he walks in the door. She's like, what is this? And he's like, I don't know. It's my book that my buddy, she's like, who gave it to you? And he's like, my buddy Mike or whatever. And she's like, we're never hanging out with Mike again. Mike's sick. He's disgusting. And you're not reading this stuff anymore. And there was this moment where he came back from the coffee shop. He's like, dudes, I can't even. And I realized, man, do people not know this? This is normal life. That's why it's a fight. We can't be naive to this. See, Jesus knows this is a thing. This is why he says, if you lust after a woman, it's adultery in your heart, because it's not like he said, maybe if there's one guy who lusts ever, I better tell them about this. There's a thin line between beauty and fantasy. And that's what, see, this is what I love about my wife. She knows, right? If we're in a restaurant or we're in an airport and a beautiful woman walks in, she knows, even if my back's to the door, that I already know she's there. She just knows that that's me and we talk about it and it's something that's an open conversation. I'm not blind. See, there's something inherent in us. God made women beautiful. There's a piece of the creation story that talks about that women, in a sense, are the pinnacle of creation, right? There's stories about guys standing beside the Grand Canyon and they're looking at it and then a woman walks by and they turn away from the Grand Canyon and they look at the woman. Why? Because that's the way it is. And even other women know this, that women are the pinnacle of creation. And it's true also that women lust toward men. We're going to talk about that in a second. The reality is this is a human problem, and to be naive about it and to bury ourselves is just dumb. And it's naive and it's to denying the biblical story. And so here's the reality. The problem's with us and the problem's with the culture that we live in. It's trying to mess us up at every turn. Let me give you some statistics around pornography right now, which is one of the predominant forms of lust in our culture, in the way that the devil actually wants to deceive and lead people astray. There's over $3,000 is spent on porn every second on the internet. At least 30% of all data transferred across the internet is porn related.
There was an average increase of 24% in traffic during the global quarantine periods amidst the coronavirus outbreak. More than 50% of people engaging in online pornographic interactions admitted to losing interest in sexual intercourse with their loved one or their spouse, whatever. Porn sites received more regular traffic than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined each month. 90% of teens and 96% of young adults are either encouraging, accepting, or neutral when they talk about porn with their friends. 64% of young people actively seek out pornography weekly or more often, and all of them hide it from their parents. So if you're a parent and you're like, well, my kid doesn't do it, you don't even know what you're talking about. You need to start getting into conversations with your kids. 51% of male students and 32% of female students first viewed porn before their teenage years. The first exposure to pornography among men is 12 years old on average. Within the church, 64% of Christian men and a high percent of Christian women say they watch porn at least once per month. Here's a random fact. The overall favorite time for viewing pornography is 11 p.m. on a Sunday night. I don't know what the psychology is there. Maybe the stress and the pressure and the anxiety of work coming up the next day, because that's one of the things that actually causes lust in our life. Pressure, tiredness. It's one of the things you have to do to fight it, to know yourself. One of the top ranked porn sites in the world is actually listed as one of the top 10 sites on the entire internet. Over 42 billion visits a year. ABC News, Nightline News talks about how porn sites are actually Hollywood's X-rated cousin because it's an industry of $12 billion a year. There's an estimated 370 million pornographic websites on the internet. It's easier to access than fast food. The industry is trying to convince you that it's harmless and that it's normal. This is the world we live in. And we got to point this out over and over and over again. Because here's the thing we got to understand. Brian Walsh, who's this theologian, philosopher, he says this: we live in Babylon. In all of its piety, the church serves to give an air of normality when it bows to an idolatrous, constructed culture. And the church functions as a polite cover-up for a comfortable life in the empire when it doesn't kick against the ways of the world. The crisis of Christianity, he says, is that Christians by and large accept the empire, listen to this, as normal. But Christians should feel disjointed and out of place in a civilization which divinizes things, meaning it makes gods out of things. The practicing Christian, he said, should feel like a Martian in this world. He or she will never feel at home in the commodity kingdom. If the Christian does feel at home, something is drastically wrong. In what way does this apply more to my life than this sin? See, it's a different world now. As you're raising your kids, you gotta understand the way that most of us were actually exposed to this kind of sexuality was a magazine behind some dumpster when you're like 10 years old and there's one page sitting there. Now it's on your phone and there's no amount of accountability that can keep you from it. And so here's the question. The only way out of it is that you need to want to be out of it, meaning God has to change not what you do, but what you want to do. That's what has to change. And that's why Jesus goes, if you lust after someone in your heart, you've already committed adultery, because the question is, in your heart, what do you take joy in? That's the reality. So here's the science behind it to give you hope, not just to say, okay, your brain waves get messed up. Here's the hope to it. To those of you feeling shame right now, to those of you sitting watching this, and maybe porn some secret sin or lust has taken over your life and you're like, I feel hopeless. You just told me that my brain has rewired itself. Here's what the science also says, that you can rewire your brain. It has effects on our brain, but if you starve your brain, this is what Jesus is trying to say, for enough time, that you can actually rewire. And what they've said is these areas that have enlarged, once they starve it enough, it starts to actually shrink, which is why one of Jesus' solutions to the problem is beautiful, because he says, what do you need to do? In the Sermon on the Mount, what do you need to do? You gotta pluck out your eye. He says, it'd be better for you to go to heaven with two eyeballs plucked out of your brain than to go to hell and have two eyeballs at work. That's what one of Jesus' solutions is, because he knows that certain practices will actually rewire our brain, which will rewire our heart, because those two things together become the control center of our life. All right, so all that to say, it's a problem in us, and it's a problem given to us by them, the culture that we live in. So here's the big point. It's difficult, So let's give each other grace because we're all in the fight together. Let's help rather than scold and come down on people. Let's actually gather around people and help them actually have victory over this thing. And here's what we got to understand. This is not a man thing, right? I talk to women about the sin of lust and how it plays out in their life. Yes, it's porn. Yes, it's lust after that person, that hot face, that body. It's the same thing. It's all the classic ways. But there's another angle for women too. I was talking to a whole group of women about this and asking about it, and they were talking about how it plays out in the world of women in the sense of, like, think of 50 Shades of Grey, a book that sold 125 million copies. I was actually with someone. We were sitting at a beach at a Christian camp one time, and she was sitting there reading, and I walked up, and I noticed that the dust cover for her book was of one book, and I lifted up the dust cover, and she had 50 Shades of Grey under it. I'm like, what? And so it's different. It's not just visual. It can be thoughts. It can be those novels that get you hot. It can be the fantasies outside of your marriage that then for a woman that becomes enough. And so you store it up and then you don't have it for your spouse. It's not always just purely visual or sexual. It can be lusting after what they can provide. See, this is how it plays out for women oftentimes in life. What can that person provide for me? What does he do for me that my husband might not do for me? And so a lot of affairs, they start not physically, they start as an emotional connection. You lust emotionally after someone and what they can bring. And see, and here's the reality. Here's the truth that my wife, when she's counseling young women who are married, she says this brilliant point of wisdom. She says this, there's a reason why Satan works hard to get you to have sex before you're married. And then once you do get married, he does everything in his power to get you to stop having sex. Isn't that a crazy irony? How does that play out in a woman? He gets them distracted by life and kids and family and tiredness. And he destroys the purity of that on the marriage side. See, we often go, make sure that you're pure before you get married. Well, there's a reality of being pure in the context of marriage too, that men and women need to come together in the book of Hebrews, talking about keeping the marriage bed pure by keeping other people out of it. And so we need to be able to fight that. See, lust, when you lust after someone else's life, and it starts to feed that kind of energy in you. It's, give me that boat, give me that house, give me that spouse because they're nice eyes. I'm after their life. See, in this way, everybody is guilty of this thing. And so let's give grace to it. It wasn't the evil side of temptation that Adam and Eve said, oh, I want to have lust in my life. It wasn't that. They weren't twisting their mustaches going, how do we be evil? It was a good thing that they turned and then the temptation killed them. No one wakes up and goes, I want more lust in my life. They say, I want more sexual pleasure. And it works out that way in their life. It's filling an emptiness because we're kind of endlessly looking for stuff to fill us and fill us and fill us and make us feel. And we never get satisfied. And so this is one of the things. Some of you, you're like, this isn't really my thing, but you feel the same about money, whatever it is. But for many people in our culture, it is this. And so the reality is we need to make sure we don't judge, but we look at people and go, let's take the Jesus route of coming alongside of them and go, what's a way through this thing? For those of you, the Bible goes, flee from this sin that so easily entangles. And so what does that look like? If you're not married, it looks like make sure you keep yourself for marriage and you work on it with the person that you're engaged to or whatever. We're gonna keep ourselves pure, but we're also gonna be talking about that as we move toward marriage, about what our sex life is gonna look like. Because this is the sin of singleness sometimes. Augustine said it beautiful in his Confessions. He was talking to God and he says, give me chastity. But the reality in his heart, Augustine actually wanted to keep sleeping around. So he was honest with God. And if we're honest, we're looking in the mirror and saying the same thing. He said it this way. He said, give me chastity. And then he goes, but not yet. And he was going, I was afraid actually God would heal me of my lust too quickly. He would heal me of the disease which I prefer to satisfy, he said, than suppress. So why does he tell us to flee? There's a lot of skeptics kind of look at this and they go, well, the reason God tells you to flee and, you know, not sleep around or whatever is because God is anti-sex. Totally not true. Totally unbiblical. Go read the Song of Solomon. Go read throughout the Bible over and over and over again. God's saying, go, 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 have fun. Read Song of Solomon. You can't even read Song of Solomon if you're a Jew till you're 12 years old. It's too hot. It's too spicy. It gets you all sweaty. It's crazy. It's two married people going, let's have fun. This isn't just sex with the lights off in one position. This is exploratory. This is fun. It can be erotic. It can be evocative. This was Adam and Eve, right? Part of the mandate was to go and have lots of sex and love it. The other day, my non-Christian friend, we were chatting, and he was away with his wife, and they got to be away for a few days, and I said, man, I bet you had the best time. He goes, oh yeah, God would not have liked what we were doing. And I'm like, dude, he totally would have. He's like, no, it was too. I'm like, dude, no, like he would have. It's legit. Everything's in the Bible. Listen, so here's how our culture frames this thing. God doesn't like sex. It's to be not really talked about. So my kids looked at me and they said, one of my kids, is sex good or bad? So let me give you an illustration here. So let me ask you a question. I said to them, is fire good or bad? Depends on where it is. Is it in the fireplace or is it on the floor in the middle of our house? See, a house can be a warm place for everyone if the fire remains in the fireplace. Things get out of control when the fire burns down the entire house because it jumps out of, okay, so we lose the original benefits of the fire and it takes complete control when it's not in its place. That's the point. God is pro-sex. He's the most pro-sex being in the universe. Secular studies even show us that the best sex is had by married couples because good sex is actually hard work and it takes a lot to understand each other. So one of the things is having a clear picture and understanding what the biblical framework would be to fight lust in the context of marriage. 1 Corinthians 7 is a great passage. Paul goes, look, if you're married, you gotta make sure you're actually having sex on a regular basis. Not just because men are dogs or women are dogs and they're constantly wanting it just to feed some sexual pleasure. What Paul actually talks about is it's protection because Satan actually wants to destroy your marriage by making people desire things outside their marriage. And so I talk to people all the time and I sit with men who will literally cry because they're like, I'm having sex once a month, man. And even then it's not good. Or maybe it's only when we travel. Listen, that's not only stupid, it's sin. I'm talking about like in a normal marriage, like set aside, you know, if there's massive problems or physical issues, what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in a functional marriage. And as we get older and we're not in the mood or whatever, we got to get there for the sake of killing lust sometimes in our spouse. Because love is not only an emotional thing, it's not only words. We love our spouse physically. We serve them to help them with the temptation that they have in life, both men and women. And so we love them with our bodies. Men and women in some sense couldn't be more different, but there's realities of serving the other in a way that they want to be loved and served for their protection. And this is what Paul's talking about in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is a way, if you're married, to fight the sin of lust. Listen, sexual desire is not in itself sinful. In fact, it's a gift from God. He wants us to have the most pleasure, the most fulfillment, which is why he says, stop chasing lust. Because it's incompatible with the way of Christ in the world. It's incompatible with your own happiness in the world. There's a family psychologist who wrote a book and he talks about 6 or 7 steps toward divorce. And they all start with D's. And he says, you start when you get married in the dream. And the first step toward divorce, he says, is disappointment. Because disappointment then moves to discouragement, which moves to distance, which moves to disconnect, which moves to discord, which moves to divorce. And he says this, quote, focusing on what you're not getting out of the relationship and how your partner fails to live up to your expectations can kill your marriage in 2 to 3 years. And this is true sexually too. I sit with people, both men and women, in counseling all the time. And they say this, if it's not money, it's sexuality. This is the disconnect. Half of marriage counseling that I do functions around this topic. The question is this going to be a point of flourish or a point of failure in our life? We gotta fight the disconnect. So is it because he's anti-sex? No, it's because he knows how we can flourish. He has the long game. How we end up being old men and old women with kids and grandkids around us proud of our legacy means that you fight this sin before it derails your life, either privately or publicly. I was watching my buddy's father passed away suddenly a few days ago, and I was watching the funeral. They had it live streamed, and here I see this amazing man, and my buddy actually had film of the day he passed away, and he was actually he kind of dropped to the ground, and then they were waiting for the people to come to him, and in the meantime, his friends and a few of his grandkids came around. And there was like a 20-minute film I watched of just him on the ground. And the paramedics had kind of come, and his wife was sitting there just stroking his face. And the grandkids were standing around, and they were already started to share stories of grandpa as he's literally laying on the ground. And I'm like, this picture of beauty, it's beautiful. It's like, this is what I want. My family sitting around telling stories, not I derailed my life through lust. Because you know what happens? That derailment, that mistake, it's the way to become alone in life. It's the way to become isolated. It's literally the definition of hell on earth, because it's the thing that you think is gonna bring you fulfillment, and you think it's gonna bring you friendship and relationship, and it isolates you and it moves you distant away from everyone you love and the God who loves you, the God who wants to save you from that. Almost maybe more than any other sin. This is your personal life. This is private, I get it. And then we start to think because it's private, it's not hurting anyone. That's a myth for 100 reasons. It destroys our relationship with others. Ask spouses whose sex life and marriage life and family life gets destroyed by lust and promiscuity and cheating. I sat with a couple recently, two young kids. He had cheated on her, and they didn't know how they got there. And it all started with him fantasizing in certain ways, sexually, about other people. And then she would ask him about it, and listen to this, he would lie. And then he said to me, the lies became bigger and bigger and bigger, and I started getting riskier and riskier. And I thought, if I'm already lying to her about this, then maybe I could do something with someone and lie to her about that. And sooner or later, of course, it caught up with him, because you can't live with it when you love someone, when you love that person and you're living a lie. Other people go, well, I'm looking at pornography, or I'm dealing with this and it's not hurting anyone. Really? Check the statistics on sex trafficking that's connected to it. I just read an article the other day about this woman. She went up on some website and she made like $1 million in 24 hours. And all the other women on the website called her out and said, what are you doing? You just took money away from us because we're sex workers. We do these videos and we put them online and we make money from them and we're sex workers. And the whole article was people trying to cancel her because she was taking away this normal industry that we should be celebrating. This is how messed up we are, forgetting that this is the thing that feeds so much sex trafficking you don't even know. This is what God calls us out of. And he says, stop justifying a life that actually corrodes the soul from within. Stop being such a hypocritical culture that says, let's be against slavery, but let's give money to sites with sex slaves. People being beaten and drug addicts. Half these videos are women doing all of these things. A lot of them are prostitutes. This is messed up. And we pat ourselves on the back for celebrating people, for creating freedom. This isn't just private, bro. This is sin that destroys life on a scale beyond you. And it feeds down to family, friends, and the people that God goes, I want you to do two things in this world. Love me and love your neighbor. Lust destroys your neighbor. But of course, this isn't just about how lust destroys your relationship with people, destroys your relationship with God, which is why when the New Testament talks about sexuality, it says, as one writer says, this is always about that. And it says, when you join physically with another person, see, ancient culture had Plato ideas of dualism, where you would have the physical world and the spiritual world, and you could always keep them separate. What you did with your body didn't affect
your soul. And the New Testament comes out and subverts all of that. It says, no, no, what you do with your body is clearly connected to your soul. And it disconnects you from the God of the universe who actually loves you and built you spiritually to connect to him. And so how do we fight it? I think a few ways. First, we gotta be ruthless with it. John Owen said, be killing sin or it will be killing you. Jesus said, cut your eyeballs out. So you gotta starve it. What does that mean? You gotta delete apps, maybe, that you have on your phone that tempt you. See, the temptation isn't the sin, or else we're all hooped. Even Jesus was tempted. Remember, the devil came out and said, hey, I want you. Being tempted isn't the sin, it's when you engage it. And so some of you need to probably delete apps on your phone that cause you to go down that route. You gotta know yourself. Is it when I drink too much? Is it when I'm too tired? Is it when I'm at work, I'm frustrated? Whatever it is, you gotta come up with technology of accountability on your phone, Covenant Eyes or XXX Church or whatever. There's all kinds of technology. Some of you gotta change your behavioral patterns. You gotta plug your phone in downstairs when you go to bed. I don't know what it is, you gotta know yourself. And you gotta know that the temptation isn't gonna be what destroys you, it's gonna be the sin that destroys you because you start engaging the temptation. I remember I was watching a movie with my buddy and we're in a movie theater. And I got so much respect for him in this moment. A sex scene started on the scene. It wasn't like a super explicit sex scene. It was just kind of a normal kind of a superhero movie sex scene, whatever. And he's not married. And so there was a moment where I was just trying to kind of avoid it. And I looked over at him and he had his eyes closed. And I just kind of stared at him. And he had his eyes closed until he could kind of hear that the sex scene was over. I don't know how he did that, you know. And then he opened his eyes. And then I just kind of, you know, he didn't get up and go, everybody, there's a sex scene, this is inappropriate, culture, shine. He just looked inside his own heart and went, I know what I need to do to fight this in this moment. That's the picture of the fight. So there's certain behavior you're gonna have to change. C.S. Lewis said this, the moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. And the first job of each morning consists of shoving them all back and listening to that other voice, taking that other point of view, letting that other, larger, stronger, quieter life come flowing in. When is that more true than when you're trying to fight this sin? You get up in the morning, you go to bed at night, whatever, and all the thoughts and the temptations of every image you've seen, of every magazine you've looked at, and every commercial you've seen, and every app and scroll website, whatever, and it comes rushing at you at any time of day, and Lewis says the fight is to figure out how to let the life of the Spirit, as Paul would say in Romans 8, rush in, rather than the life of the world, to let that animate you and be your joy. See, lust destroys your thought life and then your real life, which is why the New Testament goes, take every thought captive to Christ. That's a crazy challenge, because when you feel it sneaking in, you got to start talking to Jesus and going, Jesus, take this from me and be practical with yourself. The narrative is, some of you are living in right now and you feel the shame and the guilt is, I'm too weak. This will always be me. This will define me. Listen. Look at me. No, it won't. Because if you know Jesus, you have the Spirit. You know what the Bible says? The same Spirit that raises Jesus from the dead is the same Spirit that lives in you. Whenever I get to pray for someone around their sickness, you know how many people I've sat and they've said, I have cancer. And I sit with my hands on them and I pray. I always pray that verse. The same Spirit that rose Jesus Christ from the dead is the same Spirit that lives in you. And we're asking Holy Spirit, heal this person. And he still does that. And he can do that in your family. He can do that in your soul. He can do that in your heart. He can do that in your life. He can kill the temptation and make you desire the things that are beautiful. That's why Paul lays out in Galatians, he goes, live according to the Spirit. Walk according to the Spirit. It's like every day, one step, one step, one step. That's the image, walk. Don't look at it like, oh my goodness, I'll never do this again. One day at a time. It's like alcohol addiction, like any addiction to anything, one day at a time. You gotta love God more than you love the sin. It's the only way to be free. I used to smoke. I loved smoking. Couldn't get me to stop. And then I fell in love with Erin, and she hated smoking. You know the only way to ever stop? This is what one writer, Thomas Chalmers, way back in the 1600s, he said, the only thing that can get you to stop at being addicted to this thing is if you get addicted to something else. He says, you can't just like displace an idol. You have to actually replace an idol. This is why God goes, you know what I'm asking you to do? Great commandment. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. What is he trying to do? He's trying to free you. The only way you can ever stop doing that sin, whatever it is to love Jesus more than you love the sin. And then you start to follow what he tells you to do because you have life in the Spirit. Walk in the Spirit, and you will not indulge the ways of the flesh, Romans 8. It's not some like new age idea of the human spirit. It's the Spirit of God living in you, making you holy, making you flourish, making you win this fight. Let that possibility sink in and then go after it, because it's an active model. It's not just sit around and hope it comes to you. You got to walk in. The only way to do any of this is to exchange the one great love for another, to change your appetite, to meet Jesus. Because you know what he says? He talks about himself as food in John chapter 6. And he says, by tasting the food that is me, that is incorruptible, you're never going to hunger for anything again. Just let that sit with you for a sec. Have you tasted and seen that the Lord is good? Because once you do, nothing else can satisfy you. That's what the gospel wants you to free you from. Jesus never had sex. In his earthly life, he was 33 years old. Never fell to the sin of lust. Why? Because he had a joy in God that transcended his need to feed lust. That's the secret. And he died for that sin in your life. So right now, if you're sitting there watching this, if you've gotten this far and you feel shame and you feel guilt, that's the last thing the gospel does. It wants to set you free. It wants to say he took all, every time you've lusted, he was on the cross dying for that. It was hitting him. He became sin so that you might become the righteousness of God. So now you get up today and you defeat it and you fight it and you walk in the new identity that he gives you, because it can be a new day for you. The life of the Spirit, the life of freedom, the life of a mind dedicated to captivity to Christ versus captivity to the curse of lust that destroys. Father, I pray for freedom in this moment. For all those watching this, listening to this, that they would bring the shame and the guilt of this sin that so easily entangles them and defines them right now, and they would lay it at the feet of the cross and know that you are taking it even in this moment right now, and you are burying it, and you are removing it as far as the east is from the west to give them new life that they can walk in, and that they would trust that and not doubt it, and not listening to the voice of the liar that says Jesus could never die for that much sin, and keep the shame and keep the lies and keep the persecution going toward their own soul. I pray they'd be free from that voice, and they would hear the voice of the shepherd who guides the sheep every day. You were worth dying for, and that's why I did it. So let my sacrifice actually apply and walk in the freedom that it provides versus trying to pay for this yourself through your own guilt and your own shame, which will never work. Live in the freedom I bring, and that would be a voice that we walk in from this day forward. In Jesus' great name we pray. Amen.